Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
The Doors, Light My Fire, from their eponymous debut album, released on the 4th of January in 1967 on the Elektra record label. And it was released as an edited single on the 24th of April that year, and it spent 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 charts and 1 week on the Cashbox 100 charts. But it only charted at number 49 in the UK.
Baby.
Ooh-uh.
Light My Fire.
What a track.
What a title. Great. I bet it was very risque in 1967. Because the last show was about 1967, or tracks from 1967.
This is part two.
And this is part two. And it looks like we're going to be doing it until the end of blasted 2020, because we've got so many tracks we can play that were all created in 1967. It was, and we said this last week, it was probably the best year for music that has ever been, for popular music. Now, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of emails of criticism about it, you know, people like the 80s, 90s, noughties, whatever, but, you know, it is our opinion, because the songs, the variety, the production techniques, the whole thing was exploding into a popular music, you know, frenzy, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, it sounds very hippie,
and,
doesn't
and,
it?
And that, yeah, and that track is all about that Vox Continental organ. I just love the sound of it. Yeah.
What a lovely...
Great,
you know, when you just sit here, it's such a luxury to be able to just sit here and listen to the music. I love it.
Well, it is. And, you know, because we don't listen too much on headphones, and actually, I'm increasingly listening to stuff on headphones, because the detail that you get... Because, you know...
So intimate, isn't it?
Yeah, and unless you're in a room with a great sound system and a, you know, an acoustically treated room so you don't get any reverb and stuff, it's very difficult to pick out the actual detail. And on there, I always thought Ray Manzarek actually played the song's bass line, as he did, with left hand on a Fender Rhodes piano bass. Now, you know, used by John Paul Jones as well, an awful lot with Led Zeppelin. Yeah. But it was doubled up.
Yeah, it was.
By, what's he called? Larry
Knechtel.
I was going to go Knechtel. Larry Knechtel.
K-N, yeah.
Who used Fender Precision bass to double up the keyboard part. And actually on that, you can really hear it now. Now you listen to it.
Yeah.
Because the thing is with those piano basses, is that they're not all that deep. And the Precision, of course, is one of the
kick-ass of
all... bass guitars, as we recently have found out, because you've been using your new one, haven't you?
I have.
Well, your old one. Yeah,
well, vintage. I'm loving it. I really love its attitude as well. It's really responsive, and it's just its presence is just very strong, and it's really great to get a groove with. I never would have imagined that a guitar could have such a different character than different guitars. It's blowing my mind. It really is. It's an incredible adventure I'm on.
Well, now you know why I have so many.
Well, I do, but I kind of got that
with you. You've got four
bases
now. You're trying to catch up, and you're actually doing it very quickly.
Well, the thing is that I was really happy with you having all that, and I actually didn't want any. more. I was really happy with the short scale and the Mike Lull. And then I realised I needed an acoustic bass because I felt left out when we were jamming and we were, you know, hanging out with friends. So it was much easier, even though, you know, it's a massive, great, big guitar.
But, though. It's a magnificent
I know it is.
I wouldn't
be without him at all now. Yeah. And it's just that, but the precision is just like another world. Anyway,
back to the Doors. But this album, The Doors, was really the central to the progression of psychedelic music because what they did in that is they did cut, the record company cut it down to 3 minutes, didn't they?
Yeah,
and
they
it's
did
a terrible
edit.
If you
edit,
listen to the edit, it's not great. Somebody's taking a razor blade to the tape.
Basically they cut out all the instrumental break.
Yeah. And really, it doesn't work with that instrumental break, you know, because that monotony and that sort of very spacey sounding guitar, and great, you know, lovely guitar there.
Yeah.
And it was recorded at Sunset Sound, the classic studio where Prince did Purple Rain and marvellous ex-garage on, started by Walt Disney, of course, the Disney company.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
produced by Paul A. Rothchild. And engineered by Bruce Botnick, who we mentioned last week.
Indeed, Bruce.
Yeah, because he engineered the Love track,
of course,
didn't he?
Which
yeah.
is obviously one of our favourite songs of the whole era.
Indeed, and written. This was written by Robbie Krieger.
Yeah, yeah.
Ka-ching. But
it was Do you know it sold over 20 million copies?
Well,
I mean, it's been an absolute huge success, but the album didn't chart in the UK to start with.
Yeah,
and
said
I find that quite well. This it got to number 49 as a single, but the album itself, The Doors, did not chart.
Mm.
And it was only the film The Doors that I think it resurfaced and it got this whole new sort of wave of enthusiasm, because I remember seeing that film, and I'd never really known about The Doors, and it evokes the 60s in a way. Like, you know, you get your typical student guy who's a filmmaker who, you know, that he loves, he fell in love and he's climbing up vines and there's all the romance and stuff and the expression of, and then it starts just to go mad, doesn't it, really?
It does.
But I think really with Jim Morrison, we've got a photo of him up on the wall in the studio here, and it's the one where he's actually just lying on the stage holding his microphone.
Yeah.
And I mean, as far as a performance goes as well, I mean, he was just dynamite, an absolute, you just can't take your eyes off him. And I think that he really, and the whole band and the sound represented the year and that era, didn't it? In such a
well, he
an
I think
impactful
he
way.
Really defined, Jim Morrison, defined the rock vocalist. Because before that, I mean, Mick Jagger as well was always very good, but he was always shaking his head. Mick Jagger had taken his inspiration from Elvis.
Yeah.
But I think Jim Morrison took it to a new level because he was doing things on stage that were overtly sexual. They were banned all over the blasted place. you know, he did look super sexy, didn't he? I mean, you know, with those black trousers on, his hair and that whole thing.
Could have done.
Well, I'm speaking from a heterosexual male point of view, but to me, I would have thought it looked pretty sexy.
He's just really, he's enigmatic and you just can't keep your eyes on him because it's just like you just wonder. I mean, I love the way that he used to sing with his back to the audience for a long time as well. That really was quite a nice thing he did. And what I like about it is his attitude. You know, you see that footage of him coming off planes and stuff at airports. And there's that story, that great story of when, because they started off doing some TV shows and they ended up, they were miming, but they were going to do a live performance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
And then Ed's producer, and also happened to be his son-in-law, Bob Precht, asked them, would they mind changing one of the lines in the song? Because, girl, we couldn't get much higher. The sponsors of the show were a little bit uncomfortable with the possible reference to drugs. And even though they kind of said, look, you know, it's literally getting higher like in the sky, the band agreed and they did a rehearsal. And so they used the alternative words, girl, we couldn't get much better. But during the live performance, Jim didn't give two bananas and a hoo and sang higher. It was fantastic because Ed Sullivan didn't know what to do. He didn't shake his hand when he got off stage. They were in this negotiations to do like a multi-program thing. And they basically said, you know, you'll never do the Ed Sullivan Show again. And Jim just turned around and said, we just did the Sullivan Show.
deceive me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and that I don't know about the little tricks you play, and never see you when deliberately you put things in my way. Well, here's a poke at you, you're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. You took advantage of my trust in you when I was so far away. I saw you holding lots of other guys, and now you've got the nerve to say that you still want me. Well, that says maybe, but you gotta stand trial, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah. Deceive me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. The Eiffel Tower and the Taj Mahal might be on clear days. You thought that I would need a crystal ball to see right through the haze. Well, here's a poke at you, you're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna need that smile, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles.
The Who, I Can See For Miles and Miles and Miles and Miles, from the third studio album, The Who Sell Out, released on the 15th of December 1967 on Track Records in the UK and Decca Records in the US. And it was also released as a single on the 18th of September that year, hitting number 10 in the UK and number 9 in the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
Hot.
In the US. Now.
Yes.
The inspiration for Helter Skelter by the Beatles, because Paul McCartney heard it and he said it was the, was it the angriest or the most powerful track he'd heard or something?
Yeah, he read a journalist report article, and Pete Townsend had said it was the loudest, biggest song they'd ever recorded. So, he, of course, it was like the gauntlet was slapped and duly thrown down.
Well, Helter Skelter, great. Of course, the recording of Helter Skelter and the Beatles recording technique. anybody who listens to the show regularly will know that I just love Jeff Emerick, and I love that those Beatles recordings. So I'm afraid Helter Skelter sounds an awful lot better than this, but
I agree.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, it's a fantastic. So what? Again, noticing something else.
What's
I noticed that?
That
John Entwistle's pedaling, which means basically doing the same note all the way through those. Yeah, because you know, Pete Townsend. I was reading an interview with him ages ago, and he was talking about how he used suspended chords, and that's what he does. And right. What about suspended chords is that they're actually a chord that it sort of doesn't resolve. It sort of, they just hang there, and he keeps moving these chords around, like substitutes a classic one, ba 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 ba, and that's over one chord, but they're all like suspensions, and it adds a certain mystery, and that is
the
Who's
the feel.
Sound,
yeah,
that is yeah. really what gives it, you know, the thing. But Entwistle, I mean, what a marvellous, you know, bass player. And the drummer, you know, Keith Moon, he doesn't sound like a blasted drummer because he's not a drummer. He's just hitting things, it sounds like hitting randomly. And at the end, he's doing this snare thing. There's no real backbeat. It's a chaotic three-piece, you know, with Roger Daltrey fronting it. But it...
They rarely performed it live, you know, because it was too complex for a live performance with all the vocal harmonies and the percussion style, so it was difficult for them to play live.
Is that right?
Yeah. So they didn't do that. But Pete Townsend wrote that song, and he'd written it like the year before, and he was like really, really peeved off that it didn't do better because he thought it was going to be their like secret, right, I'm holding back on this. When we release it, it's going to be our first number one. And it didn't. It didn't do as well as he thought. So he was really... really peeved off, actually. But the whole thing about this album as well, from the Who Sell Out, I didn't know it was a concept album and it was all about pirate radio.
No.
Yeah, because the band had been profoundly influenced by listening to rock and roll on the radio.
Ah.
And remember the old days when the BBC, they didn't broadcast much contemporary music at the time. So in 67, so basically you had to listen to Radio Luxembourg or pirate radio, like Radio Caroline. I remember Radio Luxembourg. I had a sticker on my art book at school. But by the end of 1966, right, the Who had achieved commercial success because they had a load of support from the mods who made up a significant section of their early audience.
Indeed.
But the mods movement started to fade. The TV show Ready, Steady, Go, you know, that music show, that boosted the group to fame. That was cancelled. So they started touring the USA the following year and started to get some success there. And it was in the summer of 67 that their manager, Kit Lambert, and Chris Stamp, their managers, suggested the band should create like a concept album based on pirate radio.
Yeah.
So pirate radio had been influential to mods, so it felt like a really great tribute. And this is where it all starts. The Marine Broadcasting Offences Act came into effect at midnight on the 14th of August in 1967, outlawing all pirate radio stations and strengthening the album's tribute to pirate radio.
Right. And what you don't know about this particular album
is
this was remastered in 1995 by our friend John Astley.
Really?
Yeah, and Andy McPherson from Revolution Studios in Manchester, who worked an awful lot.
Right.
And John Astley does all the mastering for the Starlight Company.
For us.
That's right. So there we are. And I know he's had a big connection because he did the Who Live at Leeds. He's done a lot of work on Who.
But sometimes, you know, I don't think about that. It's really odd, isn't it?
Yeah. But John Astley, the man.
The beat goes on. The beat goes on. The drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da. Charleston was once the rage, history has turned a page, The miniskirt's the current thing, Teeny Bopper is our newborn king,
goes on, beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da.
The grocery store, the supermarket. Men still keep on marching off to war.
Electrically they keep a baseball score.
And the beat goes on, the beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da.
Grandma's sitting in chairs and reminisce.
Boys keep chasing girls to get a kiss.
The cars keep a going faster all the time. Goes on, the beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da.
And the beat goes on.
Yes, the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
Sonny and Cher, The Beat Goes On, released as a single in January 1967 on the Atco record label. It also appeared on their third studio album, In Case You're in Love. And that was released 2 months later, and the song peaked at number 6 in the Billboard Hot 100 charts in the US. I love saying that. I know I'm a child. Number 8 in the Dutch Top 40 and number 29 in the UK singles charts.
Written by Sonny Bono.
And it's difficult. Sonny Bono.
Yeah.
Sonny Bono.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the backing music played by the magnificent Wrecking Crew. Now,
darling, just hang fire for one moment, because okay, it's all about the bass.
I'm afraid it is.
It is. And obviously one of my heroines of the bass, Carole Kaye, was on that session. She was one. Oof. She was the bass player, basically, for the Wrecking Crew, wasn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were others, but
the one that we know about and love. And she came up. She changed it. It was a walking bass line originally, and she changed to that groove. Doom, doom, doom.
Well,
and you see it on the documentary as well. She talks about it.
You do.
Yeah.
Great documentary. But the sound is fantastic as well. It's a great bass sound with a pick. She's using a pick on it, and
she's showing off.
Yeah, it's got that, but it's got a lot of attack to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the groove is spectacular, because it really is the song, isn't it?
It's a big production that you can hear it. I love it. I love these headphones just listening to it. I didn't know that Cher was actually called Sherilyn Sarkisian.
Well, neither did I.
No, and Sonny was Salvatore Bono.
No.
Yeah, they first met in a coffee shop in LA. How cool is that?
Wow.
But she was 16 in 1962.
Wow.
And he was 11 years older than her, you know. And he was working for record producer Phil Spector at Gold Star Studios in Hollywood at the time. So they started hanging out. Then they fell in love. And then they were supposedly married in 1964, but apparently they didn't really officially get married until their first child, Chastity, was born. But through her relationship with Bono, Cher started as a session singer. So she was singing backup on several of Spector's classic recordings, including, get this, Be My Baby by the Ronettes, yeah. And You've Lost That Loving Feeling by the Righteous Brothers.
No!
You know, yeah, exactly.
Holy moly.
So when they first started going out as a duo, they were called Caesar and Cleo.
No. What a terrible name.
I know. Well, they had this major hit, I Got You, Babe. And then they had Bang Bang, My Baby Shut Me Down. And then they had Alfie as well. And their career just took off and they just were going, touring the world. They had loads of TV shows. They did have a film that flopped, apparently, in 1967.
Okay.
You know, like the whole thing with like Elvis and he was doing his films. Where yeah. They were trying to capitalise on their popularity of the time. And so they did this film called Good Times, major flop. So the next film they'd lined up was called Speedway and they got dropped and Elvis Presley and Nancy Sinatra took over.
Is that right?
I know. But this is what I didn't know about them and I just wanted to get this in there before we move on to the next track.
Mm.
By 1968, their career had stalled, right, and their album sales had quickly dried up. It was so up and down in those days. Their gentle, easy-listening pop sound and drug-free lifestyle had become unpopular in an era increasingly consumed with the psychedelic rock of the evolving landscape of American pop culture during the late 60s.
Well, you know...
Who would have thought that?
Well, you wouldn't.
No, but, you wouldn't.
So they were too clean?
Yeah.
Blimey. Oh, you know, and when you look at the Wrecking Crew as well, because they were like super clean session guys, you know. I mean, you know, because they were used to work all the time, didn't they, these guys?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And on that, and I didn't know this, but on that track is a guy called Barney Kessel. And Barney Kessel was probably one of the world's greatest jazz guitar players.
Really?
Well, yeah, oh yeah. He had a Gibson named after him. He was everywhere. And Jim Gordon on drums, of course, who yeah. worked with... Clapton and lots of other people, you know,
yeah.
but you know, the talent in America was so incredible then, and such a different sound. It had a rich sound, it had a different sound to the very aggressive and attacking sound of British rock.
$6 in my hand, up to Lexington, 125, feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive, I'm waiting for my man. Hey white boy, what you doing? All women around. Oh, pardon me, sir. It's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to a dear friend of mine. I'm waiting for my man. He comes. He's all dressed in black. Shoes and a big straw hat. He's never early,
Velvet Underground. I'm waiting for The Man from their debut album, The Velvet Underground and Nico, released on the 12th of March 1967 on the Verve record label. It was also released as a single 4 years later, written by Lou Reed, produced by Andy Warhol. Now, you know headphones, I mentioned headphones before.
Yes.
I've never noticed that gradually it's either the backing track's getting louder, which I think it is slightly, and Lou Reed's vocal is going down in the mix. At the beginning, it's right up there, right? So it gives a feeling of power as the...
intensity.
As the whole track progresses. And I love the way at the end he says, take it home, you know, which is like a... it's like a bit of a rock and roll thing, you know, because people often say, you know, take it home. So at the end of the track, you know, they're the band to take it home, you know, to the turnarounds and to finish it off. And it's what a great expression. But this is proto-punk.
Proto, here we go.
It is.
Proto-punk.
It's proto-punk. That's what it is. And art rock. And, you know, and when I was talking before about, you know, or you were talking about Sonny and Cher being too clean and their album sales dropped off.
This is the
antithesis of clean, because these boys were and girls were up to all sorts of nonsense, you know.
I'm writing about it as well. That's a thing.
Yeah, that's right. And this is all about a drug dealer. It's all about his drug dealer that he was picking up stuff from, you know.
Yeah.
The Man. And I love the Velvet Underground, and we do listen to a lot of them. And I started listening to them again because we remember Joe, our youngest son, was playing a lot at his house. We stayed with him for a couple of months early on in the year.
Yeah.
An unintentional 2 month stay. Thank you very much, Joe and Christina.
Thank you. Thank you, Shin.
But he was playing an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
And some of it's pretty horrible. But the songs, there's some great songs in there, and some of the great episodes, and this is one of the great ones.
I think this is the one of the examples of when an album doesn't sell and initially doesn't connect in terms of like a commerciality, but ends up being one of the best albums of all time. Mm. Now that statement fries my head. I really can't fathom it.
Yeah,
and Brian Eno said something along the lines with that, didn't he? Said while the album only sold, I think it was about 30,000 copies. Mm. He said everybody who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band.
We'll be right back.
John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, The Stumble, from the third album and second studio album, A Hard Road, released on the 17th of February in 67 on Decca Records in the UK and London Records in the US of A.
Written by Freddie King, Sonny Thompson. Freddie originally released it in 1961, but this
is all about
Peter Green, my favourite blues guitar player. I honestly cannot tell you how much I love this guy, you know, and I know I wax lyrical about him. His sound, those licks that he plays there are beautiful licks. That dee boo doo 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 boo. What is, oh, every time I listen to it, I think it's amazing. And the fact is he makes mistakes in it because he can't quite get there in time. And one of those he makes a slight mistake there. He makes a couple of mistakes in it. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He's doing it off the cuff. It is magical guitar playing. Absolutely magical. And, you know, I cannot think of one other guitar player that has been since playing the blues, certainly White, that has managed to achieve anything close to Peter Green. And that's including Clapton, everybody. That's it. Done. Finished. That's all I can say.
The look of love is in your eyes. The look your heart can't disguise. The look of love is saying so much more than just words can ever say.
Listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was the luscious Dusty Springfield, The Look of Love, from the spoof James Bond film Casino Royale, which really spoiled it for me, actually, released on the 29th of January 1967 on the Cold Gems record label, written by the unbelievable Burt Bacharach and Hal David. This film was only released 2 months before You Only Live Twice with Sean Connery. It was a spoof. I remember seeing it with David Niven. I forgot this was from that song, from that movie, say. And the production and the quality of sound recording, the reverb on her voice is luscious. That saxophone, throaty, you can hear the spit coming off the reed. It's beautiful.
I'm in love with it, actually. Yeah. It's funny, you know, because I know the Dionne Warwick version a few years later, but I don't really know the Dusty Springfield one, and I'm just sat here with my mouth open going, and I feel so almost teary, you know. It's so beautiful, so beautiful.
Well, she signed eventually with Atlantic Records to invigorate her career and work with Tom Dowd, Arif Martin and Jerry Wexler, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Later on.
I mean, so Dusty, you know about her. You know, she's the icon of the swinging 60s.
Yeah.
She had like 6 top 20 singles on the US Billboard Hot 100, 16 on the UK singles charts from 63 to 89. She's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the UK and stuff. I mean, It's incredible, though, to see her career go up and down. So then again, you've got the same thing happening in 67. Her status in the music industry was affected by the progressive music revolution and that uncomfortable split between what was underground and fashionable and what was pop and unfashionable. So that's why she signed to Atlantic, right? And what was lovely with Jerry and Tom and Arif was that they were saying that she wasn't that confident, you know. It's quite interesting. And they were saying that they thought that her vocals needed to sort of be more to the front and that they didn't want her to compete with a big string section. So it was the first time she recorded with just a rhythm section.
Well, that just sounded just unbelievable.
I've got a story to tell you, though.
Go on.
You can't see the notes just underneath here. Right? I was so
excited.
Okay,
go on.
Right, during the sessions in Memphis when she was recording, right, Dusty suggested to Jerry Wexler that he should sign a band that was newly formed from the UK called Led Zeppelin.
No.
Yep. She knew John Paul Jones, the bass guitarist, because he'd worked as a session guitarist on her earlier albums.
Wow.
Right? So without ever having seen them, and partly on Dusty's advice, Jerry Wexler signed Led Zeppelin to a $200,000 deal with Atlantic Records, which at the time was the biggest contract for a new band. Get in there, Dusty Springfield!
Ready?
Otis Redding and Carla Thomas, Knock on Wood, from the album King and Queen, released on the 16th of March 1967 on the Stax Atlantic record label. You can tell it's the Stax.
Yep.
Released a single. It peaked at number 8 on the Hot Rhythm and Blues Singles charts, number 30 on the Hot 100 charts, written by Eddie Floyd and the Colonel, Steve Cropper,
the
who
Colonel.
Also played guitar on that record.
You were.
Because it was basically the backing band from Stax, Booker T and the MGs.
Yep, and the Memphis Horns.
We love those
friends.
Memphis Horns, yeah.
And a pianist called Isaac Hayes.
Yeah, who's he?
You don't know.
Yeah, there we are. And Donald Duck Dunn on bass. Great.
I love that bass.
Fabulous bass. And, you know, what a great, 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 great drum part by L. Jackson Jr. I mean, and it's mixed really high as well, but it's just the groove is fantastic.
You know, it was Jim Stewart's idea. He was a co-founder of Stax with his sister. He wanted to get the two of them together because he thought, you know, it would really help their careers. And also Marvin Gaye had had great success working with Tammy Terrell and Kim Weston. Mm. So he was thinking, oh, you know, put those two kind of together, there's going to be a great chemistry. And when you look into his life, I didn't know there was such a sad ending. But in terms of, I mean, Otis Redding is considered one of the greatest singers in the history of American popular music.
That's right.
Soul music, rhythm and blues. And, you know, sometimes you don't really register that. You kind of know of Otis, but you don't really know how incredibly influential he was. He quit school at 15, you know, because he wanted to look after his family.
No.
Yeah. So he ended up working with Little Richard's backing band.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Upsetters.
Upsetters, that's great.
It's kind of good, that, eh? And then he was, like, performing in talent shows, and then he was in Johnny Jenkins' The Pine Toppers, and he was touring in the southern states. And then he just ended up, by accident, working on a Stax recording session, and he ended up landing a record deal.
Yeah, well,
how cool
surprising.
Is that? So his first single was These Arms of Mine in 62, and he was initially popular mainly with African Americans, but he later reached a wider American pop music audience. And he used to play shows in the American South and later LA's nightclub, Whiskey A Go Go. There's something about that place, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were talking about the Doors earlier on, of course.
The scene. And,
you know, yeah, there was a huge scene there, it really was. And just to bring it back to 1967, all these tracks today and last week and the next few weeks coming up are all from 67.
Yeah.
And the variety is so incredible. We've got soul, we've got proto-punk, we've got rock, we've got blues, we've got, you know, psychedelic stuff. It's unbelievable. And then, you know, you've got the smooth sound, the Burt Bacharach written, you know, what you call it, Bond theme, you know, the fake Bond movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible.
The only reason they did the spoof, by the way, was because the guy who bought the rights couldn't get on with the actual people. Eon, I think they were called, the company that actually produced the James Bond films.
All right, yeah.
So that's why he had to do a satire about it, because he couldn't work together with them. He actually wanted to produce an authentic James Bond film.
Yeah.
So that was his approach.
Well, Broccoli was in charge, wasn't he? You know, Albert Broccoli,
if I
remember correctly.
I saw his name again earlier today and I thought, oh, do I? That's such a funny name. But this whole, like, 1967, the more and more I look into it, you've got everything for your mum and dad. And there's the spending power as well. You've got the invention of the motor car, and you've got the urban sprawl as well. And you've actually got teenagers and young people getting a voice and also being able to have money of their own.
That's
to
right,
have their
yeah.
own say with things. And the invention of the motor car as well was a very, very important liberation for young people. But now they seem to think that they can take over the world. Well, they can't.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a pill as well, you know, sexual liberation for, you know, the women of the day. It really changed the whole thing. But anyway, that is the end of the show, I'm afraid.
I know, we're going to play you out with a band called the Lemon Pipers and a fantastic song called Green Tambourine.
Psychedelic rock from Ohio.
Silver in my tambourine. Help a poor man build a pretty dream. Give me pennies, I'll take anything. Now listen while I play.
green tambourine. Watch the jingle jangle start to shine. Reflections of the music that is mine. When you toss a coin, you hit it sing. Now listen while I play my green tambourine. Drop a dime before I walk away. Any song you want.